Get started here. I can't call the committee to order because we do not have a quorum at the moment. But, you know, it is the first bill for Representative Uglem today. So I expect we're going to need about 25 or 30 minutes for that particular bill.
Sure, thank you.
And so I want to make sure we have enough time for that. So if our first bill on the calendar today will be referred to the Capital Investment Committee, and it is House File 2059, McNamer, Greater Minnesota Business Development. So please come on down and give us your thoughts.
Thank you, Chair Mahoney.
After you identify yourself for the tape.
Okay. I'm Representative Jay McNamer, West Central Minnesota. Thank you, Chair Mahoney, committee members. My bill does have a name. It's called a Business Development Public Infrastructure Grant. My bill is a grant program for Greater Minnesota cities and counties. The grant will cover up to 50% of the capital costs of public infrastructure necessary to expand economic development, retain, or create jobs. Cities will benefit from this program, allowing them to attract new businesses and create jobs in the community. This is not a new program. It's been around since 2003, and it has been successful. It can be used for developing manufacturing, technology, warehousing and distribution, research and development, agricultural processing, and industrial parks. We're asking to be placed in the bonding bill, and you mentioned that, and we're asking for $25 million. I have brought my bill to mayors in rural West Central Minnesota. They were extremely interested by it. Rural Minnesota is starting to expand and create jobs faster than most people ever realize. This grant is a perfect fit, and it will help us continue the creation of new jobs. As a matter of fact, Tim Meehl, Mayor of Perm, has his city administrator here today to testify for us. Amanda Dura will elaborate on what I've just said.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Amanda Dewar, and I represent the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities. I'm just going to tell a little bit about the history of the Business Development Public Infrastructure Grant Program. It's administered by DEED, and it does have a very strong record of success. Since it was first passed in 2003, 107 cities throughout Greater Minnesota have received program grants to support 172 economic development projects. The programs help create 3,125 jobs and retain 4,052 jobs. The program also has a great return on investment. The $49.1 million that's been appropriated by the legislature has leveraged more than $142 million in total investments. Historically, the BDPI grant program has received bipartisan support. In the past, both Governor Pawlenty and Governor Dayton have included the program in their bonding recommendations. This year, the governor included $5 million for the program in his recommendations. House File 2059 would provide $25 million for the BDPI grant program. And the reason the CGMC is proposing an increased level appropriation, two reasons. First, the program balance is nearly depleted and actually will be depleted as soon as these two pending projects get finalized. And there are many cities out there that would like to apply for BDPI funding for economic development projects. I just did a quick survey of EDAs and city administrators from around the state, and just sent to me is over $6.8 million worth of projects in cities like Perham, Pelican Rapids, New Ulm, Princeton, Winsted, Laverne, Bellingham, Windham, and St. Michael. There's more out there, like Representative McNamer mentioned. The second reason we were asking for additional funding is we are recommending increasing the maximum grant amount from $1 million to $2 million to help fund some larger scale infrastructure projects. And obviously, if the cap is raised, you need more funding to do more projects. So the CGMC hopes that the committee will include BDPI program funding in its bonding recommendations. And now I'm going to turn it over to Kelsey Clem, who's the city manager of Perham, and we also have Clay Wilfart from the city of Winsted.
Chairman, committee members, thank you. Again, this is Kelsey Clem. I'm the city manager in Perham. I just want to start off with just telling you a little bit about Perham. Perham is located in Otter Tail County, right along US Highway 10. We have a population of about 3,000, but we do provide jobs to over 4,500 people in the area. We are the home to KLN Family Brands, which is the parent company to Barrel of Fun Potato Chips, Tuffy's Pet Foods, Kenny's Candies, and they recently started a new business of Nuthead's Chocolate Factory. We're also home of Bongard's Creameries. Bongard's Creameries produces all their cheese in Perm, Minnesota. And over the last 10 years, we've added about 1,200 jobs. And we continue a consistent streak of adding about 100 jobs per year. But with that growth does come some challenges. It comes infrastructure challenges is one of them. The city has used the BDPI program 3 times in the last 10 years, one of them being an expansion project for Barrel of Fun, second one being running utilities to a new $35 million critical care hospital, and then the third one was part of a larger transportation economic development project, a TED project where we did a new interchange off of Highway 10. Roughly off those 3 grants, we've compiled a private investment of about $65 million and about 400 of those jobs tied to that funding. We're here today because we also have another project we're looking at. We continue to grow, which is good news, and to our delight, our industrial park is running out of space. The last 2 years, we've had a run on lots. We've sold 12 lots in the last 2 years, and we only have 5 lots remaining that have infrastructure. So what we'll be seeking BDPI funding for is to basically build out the rest of our industrial park with utilities. And as you know, industrial infrastructure is difficult to finance. The cost of putting in 10-ton streets, oversized in water and sewer lines to meet these businesses is expensive. It's an expensive endeavor coupled with land acquisition cost. The grant program provides the funding that we need to keep the assessments and the prices reasonable. So really, we're still a partner in Greater Minnesota. We're an attractive option to industries who are looking to expand or relocate. With that, it is a competitive grant program. So even though PERM will be vying for that money just like all these other communities, but we do think it has a proven track record as far as other private and public investment and job creation.
Thank you for your testimony. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the tape.
Thank you, Chairman and committee members. My name is Clay Wilford. I'm the city administrator for the city of Winsted, Minnesota. I've also worked in the past in the city of Elk River. While I was in the city of Elk River, I wrote a grant application for the BDPI program to help fund infrastructure development for a business park. The city of Elk River was awarded dollars through the BDPI program in 2012. To complete infrastructure development for the first of 3 phases of that development park. Within a year of receiving that grant, the city had invested over $500,000 of its own money, and then also sold over 10 acres of that land, attracted nearly $5 million in private investment, $100,000 a square feet of manufacturing were developed, and an anticipated 35 to 50 jobs were brought to Elk River. And that first phase of the industrial park is only half complete at this time. I'm now the city administrator of Winsted. Winsted has a rich history of manufacturing. There are over 500 people in the community employed in manufacturing alone, which isn't bad for a town that's just over 2,000 people in population. Most of the manufacturers who have developed recently have done so on land that was sold by the city. And in fact, the city's most recent industrial park brought about $5 million of investment to our small community and over 100 jobs. Currently, Winsted has no more city land that's available to sell. And as the administrator from PERM was mentioning, the infrastructure costs as well as the costs of land make it prohibitive for communities to invest in it and make it a prudent financial decision. So as such a small city, we would not be able to buy land and lay infrastructure unless we are to receive financial assistance from the outside, which is why we're so adamantly in favor of the BDPI program. We will rely heavily, as I mentioned, on the program to bring new investment and new jobs in our small manufacturing community. So I would hope that the committee would consider supporting this program, because supporting that is supporting growth in jobs and the economies of small communities like ours. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there any questions? Representative Norton, did you have a question?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. This has been a really successful program, and I'm I'm just curious, and you may have said it and I missed it, but you've increased the grant amount to $2 million, and yet your data says that small grant amounts of $250K to $500K are the average. And so I guess I'm looking for the rationale why you want to up the grant rather than keep it low and give out more.
Yes, Representative Norton, we've heard feedback from cities, especially in Northwest Minnesota, that have identified some larger scale infrastructure projects that would be needed and much more expensive, you know, and to kind of be able to put those in place. And it's a 2 year, so if it's more of a longer term project, you know just to continue the work going forward on there, because it's like a 2 year cap, so if you know the project has phases that can be built in over time.
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
And Representative Norton.
Yeah, and I can understand that, and I know, and having done the bonding tours, we did see some, you know, significant needs in certain areas that we want to address, and you're just comfortable that that won't cause an increase in other grants and just have larger grant requests that are used up quickly, that it really won't affect the amount on the other regular grants, the average type grants you're getting.
Yeah, and Representative Norton, Mr. Chair, just in the quick survey I did, you know, I included the list of members, and there's a whole wide range of costs for that, like small from $150,000 to, you know, $250,000, and then some like $1.3 million. So I think, you know, there are the smaller scale projects, just depending on the community and their needs. So I think just to provide a little bit flexibility.
Okay, thank you.
Any Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This would be a question for Mr. Clem. Just in terms of what I heard from your testimony, I'm just curious in terms of if you were not to receive funding through this type of a program, how would projects of an infrastructure nature be paid for otherwise?
Representative Clem.
Chairman, for one thing, we probably will hold off. It's difficult. Otherwise, you'd have to do special assessments. You'd have to do be a burden on city tax levy, because we'd still have to do those assessments to where the market can bear, and then the rest would have to be borne probably by a local tax levy. It's industrial parks are they're challenging. They're not something that privately, it's not an investment you probably would want to make. But as communities, it's important for us to have those parcels available for job creation and eventual tax base growth. So it's kind of a necessary evil to bear those costs. But without the grant money, there would be no other option other than local levy support and special assessments.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So is there any type of an incentive, a match, or some type of skin in the game from the part of the municipality or the entities, the businesses that are actually going to participate in the benefits from these programs?
Chairman, the BDPI program is a 50-50 match, so we have to match it.
Chairman Mahoney, can I speak to that also? Perm is not a large community. We're small. So most of our workers are from surrounding communities, and their taxes aren't involved in that. We'd be asking a small amount of people to support the industrial park, and therefore their taxes would go up substantially. Rural Minnesota is different than the metro area. We draw people sometimes from 50, 60 miles away for our industries.
Before we go any further, I'm going to call the meeting to order. So we are now officially in our meeting, and just so you know, I have more than my share of people working in my district that come from 40 or 50 miles away. We are not that different in some of that. Representative Uglum, and you better not be just trying to shorten your time frame so that we don't get the...
Mr. Chair, you've seen through my strategy as usual. Thank you, Mr. Chair. More or less a comment. As a former mayor of a metro city, a lot of times when you're doing industrial parks and things, it's pretty easy in the metro with a decent sized tax base and everything else. But from an outstate Minnesota perspective with these smaller towns, I mean, if you're sitting in a special assessment hearing, and Representative Newton knows this too from his background, if you're sitting in a special assessment hearing, that's always a difficult call as an elected official. And in a small town doing a decent-sized industrial park, the special assessments that could be put on the taxpayers of a small city could be astronomical. So really, the project probably wouldn't be built. And we all know that we do need jobs in the outstate Minnesota area. Thank you.
I've got my question here, and I want to bring this to the author's attention. On page 1, line 19, a county or city may be eligible to receive for new public infrastructure or to expand or replace. But the real line that caught my attention is 1.21. That does not meet the needs of economic development project because public infrastructure. So now we're expanding this program. You're vastly expanding this program underneath this bill, are you not?
Mr. Chair, yes. That was also feedback that we received from cities, like with aging infrastructure, you know, the water, sewer, you know, utilities could not support a business expansion. So allowing the city to go in and replace the infrastructure to meet the capacity that would be needed for a project, because sometimes with aging infrastructure, you know, putting in a new business or expanded use of these utilities, you would need to replace that to be able to support that development. And that was something that was brought to us by some of our member cities in Northwest Minnesota.
Yes, the guy from Northwest isn't around to defend this, but that's a pretty big expansion of this particular program. And you know, we have multiple cities in the state that are of significant age that, you know, I think the last piece of wood gas line has been taken out of the city of St. Paul. Wood. They used to use oak, and then they'd dry oak, and then they'd place them together and have the moisture in the ground expand the oak, and that would hold the gas inside. We've got to get to Representative Uglum, so I will pass this along, but I'm very uncomfortable with that paragraph B. So, Representative Albright, did you have a quick question?
Maybe just a follow-up or tag on to the chair's comments in terms of obviously that might include an expansion of the water treatment facility in the town, commensurate with whatever needs the industrial development might have. But I'm curious as to if you could give me an idea in terms of what the average cost of of the infrastructure projects that go along with industrial development are. Do they all need infrastructure developments, and do half of them require additions to infrastructure? Can you give me some proration in terms of what infrastructure always needs to be updated in order for industrial development to happen?
Who would like to catch that one? Step right on up.
Chairman, I think I want to just make sure I understand the question. So basically your point is to that resizing of the utilities or upsizing because of the age or size isn't appropriate? Is that the question?
I think it's Representative Albright.
Thank you, Chair. I'm just trying to identify if we're talking about business development. It's kind of a purity test in terms of understanding what amount of a grant program is going to go towards developing or attracting businesses, and what amount is, in a sense, implicit or explicit, going towards fixing what's not amenable to the town. Roads, curbs, gutter, sewer, water.
Yeah. Representative Albright, this is specifically, that would not be the use of this. The application with deed, it would have to be tied to the development attraction expansion of a business. It would not be just going in and I mean, it's still administered by deed and would be strongly connected with economic development. This just would not be a program to replace aging infrastructure at all.
Actually, we're going to...
Mr. Chair, I would concur with the paragraph. My point is... Well,
no, go ahead. Representative Albert, go ahead.
The point to the question was really to lead on. You and I were thinking alike on that paragraph starting in 1.19 in terms of the inference, in terms of where the money is projected.
Yeah. And members, we're going to move here. I think the bill's author and the advocates for the bill have kind of heard that there's some concerns with that paragraph. And before it gets to capital investment, it would probably be a good thing to talk to Deed about. So having said that, I am going to make the motion to re-refer House File 2059 to the Committee on Capital Investment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, same sign. You're on your way to capital investment with some comments.
Thank you, Chair and Committee.
We have House File 2762. Representative Uglum. And while he's getting set, Representative Newton, I know that you have read and reviewed the March 4th minutes.
I like that.
And would you care to move them?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move the minutes of March 4th.
Thank you. Are there any corrections or additions? Seeing none. All those in favor of the minutes for March 4th, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. You have that one out of the way. And I'm sure you did. You watched. You took a look at March 6th also?
Yes. I'd like to move the minutes for March 6th as well, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Newton. All those in favor of the March 6th amendments, please signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. We got our minutes taken care of. We're official, those things are.
Lunch.
Representative Uglum, did you buy those at Candyland?
No. Chair, they're leftover from deer hunting.
Oh, wow. All right,
Pick for blood.
Would you like to move your bill, Representative Uglum?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Mark Uglum, and I'm here to present House File 2762. First of all, Chair, I have an A1 amendment that I'd like to move. It's in your packet.
Did I grab the right one? Yes. Okay. A14?
A14.
Yeah. So move?
Yes.
Would you like to, this is to get the bill in the shape that the author would like?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Any comments on the amendment? Seeing none. All in favor of the A14 amendment to 2762, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Bill's in the shape that you would like.
And very good.
Before we get started, have you been to GovOps?
No, sir.
So we're referring this to the General Register, but you've got a board that you're doing?
Yes, this is the cosmetology.
Yeah, but you're changing a board, so we probably need to send you to state government operations.
Okay.
Never been there. They're nice.
I guess we're
more. Never been there.
All right, so please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have Gina Strauss here this afternoon, the executive director of the board, also to answer any questions that you may have on this bill. This is primarily a housekeeping bill. It has a couple of high points that I'd like to just go over. It does change the number of board members from 3 to 7, making it a little more democratic, if you will. Talks a little bit about license expiration dates and changes those slightly. Also, Instead of Section 7, details infectious control standards, a little bit of a change in definition from health and sanitary standards. It's just really a change in verbiage there. And actually, the rest of the bill is pretty much just some minor changes. But Gina Strauss, Executive Director, could answer any questions you may have.
Any questions for the members? Representative Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You just referred to the health and sanitary being changed to infection control, and I understand that, but you also have struck 3.27 through 3.29, which will allow services to be now rendered in a home, and most of the salons I know that are in homes are in a salon within a home. This looks like you're going to remove that, and they can just cut hair in the living room, and so I just wanted clarification, or if it's covered someplace else.
We got it covered.
Okay, good. Thanks.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Norton, if you on starting in line 4.1 on the top of page 4, basically we just the idea was to just relocate the wording because we were unclear why it was stuck in infection control for licensees to be able to find residential salons. Perfect. And then our rules actually detail out that you can't just cut in the middle of a living room, that you have to have a separate entrance as you described.
Thank you.
Representative Fabian, I was going to go off on him. All right, go ahead.
Keep your powder dry, Mr. Right. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Read through the bill a little bit yesterday or the day before, and I do have a concern about subdivision 3A on page 4 at the top. Can you tell me what the current standards are with regards to how a residence is managed?
Representative Uglum. Oh, you're going to have your testifier take care of that? Typically, when you have a first bill, you make sure you understand the whole bill. But go ahead.
Chair, I can handle that for Mr. Fabian.
Oh, no, go right ahead.
Representative Fabian, if you don't mind. Well, the 3A, actually, with the point about residential purposes and everything else, if you refer back to page 3, at the bottom, you'll see that we've lined out the old definition and replaced it with a new definition that's on 3A on the top, lines 4.1 through 4.4. So it really just makes it, I think it's just a matter of making it a little clearer in terms of what a residential salon could be.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, that's what I wanted, was some sort of clarification on, you know, why we're making this change. Is there, I know Representative Uglum, there's nothing subversive about what you're doing here, but I just wanted to be clear on that and to make sure that, you know, again, in rural Minnesota, where I live, there's a lot of these, a number of these type of facilities that are currently in use, doing business, and I just wanted to make sure that there wasn't something else that was going to jeopardize their ability to stay in business.
Representative Uglum.
Chair, Representative, no, I don't think that's the case.
How about if I ask a question here? I think we're going to get to this one here. And one of the questions that I would have, Representative Uglum, is on line 4.3, you have completely partitioned. And I would make sure that you understand what completely partitioned means, because my suspicion is that somebody, as you stand on the House floor, would try to ask that question of you, and you'd have to go to the Building Code Division, and that might take a little while as you're standing there waiting for an answer from somebody. So Representative Uglum, would you like to comment on completely partitioned, or would you like to get back to me on that?
Chair, being that I don't have the Uniform Building Code in front of me, I'm afraid I'll have to get back to you on that.
Does that kind of get to what you were trying to get to?
Yes, it does, Mr. Chair. I was kind of curious about that, too. Is it a curtain? Is it a wall? You know, and you know the building codes better than I do.
Yeah, and I don't know that one off the top of my head, so I think that is actually something that you probably need to make sure you understand.
Thank you.
So are there other questions? Representative Savitt.
Yes, I'd like to ask a question on 6.6. Refuse to serve a customer because of race, color, creed, religion, or disability, or national origin, or sex, why that was taken out.
Representative Uglum? Tina?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Savick, the entire sections starting on line, it's section 10, starting on lines 4.14 and throughout, when the Board of Barber and Cosmetologist Examiners split apart in 2010, all of this language was taken directly from the split, and they just, in order to give us disciplinary authority, and that language is obviously very outdated and not correct. So the idea of removing that language would mean that the board is no longer able to enforce that you could enforce discipline against someone who refuses based on those elements, refuses service. That's a human rights issue, and it's not a Board of Cosmetology issue. So it's just removing the board's authority to enforce that.
So
follow-up?
Yeah, follow-up. Would another law take care of that, or you said it was a human rights? Yes.
Missed out.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Savick, we would refer any sort of issues such as race, color, creed, religion, disability to either the ADA or the Minnesota Office Department of Human Rights.
Okay, thank you.
To file that complaint.
Thank you.
The chair has a question here on your amendment, and here's a I'm trying to figure out on line 1.15, you may revoke recognition at any time for just cause. Is that somewhere in statute somewhere, just cause defined?
Chairman Mahoney, the just cause would still require the board to go through a complaint process in order to take anybody's rights or liberties away, which would include that. What that helps the board with is it can be difficult in establishing when continuing education requirements. It's not in providing the class, it's not the same as a license when you can go into a salon and see that they're practicing without a license or it's different sanitation. So the idea gives the board the authority if a professional association is not providing continuing education up to the standards, meaning like if they're just putting a video in and we're getting complaints that they're throwing a four-hour video in, the teacher's walking out the door, that the just cause in that is, you know, throwing a video in and it's not meeting the continuing education standard, and it would go through the board's complaint process to take that approval away.
Representative Uglum, Ms. Stubbs, you have a kind of a guidebook or a set of rules with your board that might cover something such as this, because just cause is a pretty broad brush and leaves a lot to the discretion of the board or to someone's interpretation. And when that's the case, that typically ends up in front of a judge someday.
Mm-hmm.
So that might be something that you might want to define better or have a definition that can be broached in either in this committee, the next committee, or on the House floor. And I think Representative Norton had another question.
Yeah, and I'm sorry. I'm just trying to understand this, and I've been reading back and forth between the parts. And I guess I am somewhat disturbed in following with Representative Savick's line of questioning here. That a lot of the violations, I mean, you explained the one having to do with race, color, religion, and disability as a human rights violation, but many of the other things that you've struck, including some of them are health-related, not using new towels, excuse me,
And there's some others in here, intoxication, use of drugs. I guess I'm disturbed that they're being taken out, and in reviewing back to the section about even just the one that you've removed with infectious diseases, it says you can be, the salon may be inspected, but it doesn't really have any, how do you enforce the violations or how do you sanction them? And this gave an additional list of things you could be sanctioned for, and you've removed a great number of them. So it would help me to understand that. And then I just want to also mention you have several repealers in here. And as I'm looking at those, it has to do with customer complaints, access on a website to the board, having to do with felons being removed. So if you could explain to me how, if those are being repealed, is there another way to deal with those problems? Or I just don't know.
I'll
take the repealers. Sure. Mr. Chair. Representative, with the repealers, this is just simply trying to make things a little easier because there is an avenue for redress for all of these complaints and issues through the board, through just standard communication procedures, emails, and particularly to the director. So this has not been a problem with the board, and that's why it's in there. And the licensing of felons and repealer is already in statute as far as that goes, and that is Minnesota Statute 364.
Yep.
So it's already there. So it's just cleaning that up, that language up.
Thank you, sir.
Well, just if she could address why they've struck all the rest of the many of the provisions for violation under licensing and registration actions in Section 10, I'd appreciate knowing that.
Ms. Trout.
Chairman Mahoney and Representative Norton, if you look on line 4.22, the first licensing and registration act basically all encompasses everything, which is violating a statute, rule, or order the board has adopted. And again, so we feel that we don't need, first of all, if you pick out the towel example that you used on 5.25, that is, cosmetologists have to use a towel, but again, that's a barbering statute when the board split in 2010 that was given to us. If you look at the next one on 5.2, if you look at like line point 5.30 and the city's just left us here, but failed to have water and sewer connections from the place of practice with municipal water systems, I think that's probably 30, 40 years old that you would actually be needing to outline water and sewer systems because all of our applications require a city sign-off that the city has signed off. So the idea is, and I can go through these line by line, it's removing items such as apprentice or registration, which has to do with barbering, temporary apprentice, which has to do with barbering, and basically simplifying it where basically if you look at lines, would you like me to go through one by one, Representative or Chairman Mahoney, Representative Norton?
I think we're a little far into the hearing now to do that. I've been reading through them myself, but it might have, maybe that would have been nice at the beginning, but I don't want to ask the committee to start all over. So
I can go.
Representative Norton and Representative Uglum, I think you have been kind of given a heads up that you better be able to answer those questions when you come to the floor or to your next committee, because people will wonder about that, and you better the explanation needs to be there and what the cosmetology board's rules and where they're located in the rules for the Board of Cosmetology and how they would accept them. Mm-hmm. We'll move on. Representative Kiefer, did you have a question?
Mr. Chair, I just want to ditto what you said. I have a lot of concerns with this board. My own constituents were trying to open up a shop and trying to follow what was on the website, and then you guys told them it was not the right thing, and they said, well, wait a minute, it's right here. Well, that's different. The rule's different. This is a quagmire. I don't know that this bill fixes it, but I have a lot of concerns about it, too. Thank you.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Uglum, kind of following up on Representative Kiefer's comment on page 2, 2.3 through 2.9 with regards to the board It says there on 2.8 that they're. I'm curious to know how does one become a member of this board? First question.
Representative Uglum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Fabian, I will have to defer to our executive director on that because I don't know.
Ms. Scott.
Chairman, I want to just make sure I heard the question. Was it how you become a member of the board?
How are you appointed to the board?
All members are appointed by the governor, and that is in the bill. That's actually, it's in the amendment. It wasn't quite written exactly how the Senate wanted it, which was on line 1.21, which is appointed by the governor. So the amendment on line 1.3 is they're appointed by the governor on four-year terms, all staggered.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then I'm kind of curious about, it says, it talks about on 2.3 compensation of members. If we're going from 3 to 7, I'm kind of curious to know about a fiscal note, if there's going to be something here that we are meeting increased costs, and then also along with that is how often do they meet, and I have one more question, Mr. Chair.
Well, we'll take this one, and then we'll get to the next one. Ms. Stouse, I think you probably know the compensation.
Chairman Mahoney and Representative Fabian, it is a $55 a day per diem. The board meets approximately 6 times a year. The complaint committee meets approximately the same. The board, the legislature last year was gracious enough to give us an increased appropriation through additional funding that we would be generating on our own, and it's about a $5,000 change in our budget. I feel that the board does not need to ask the legislature for additional funding. We will absorb the cost. So if a fiscal note was generated, in the fiscal note we would be detailing out $5,000 cost, but the agency plans to absorb the $5,000.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then the last thing with regards to the board, it says appointed by the governor. Are there any guidelines for the governor to take into consideration when appointing to hear regional concerns around the state, greater Minnesota versus metro areas and so forth?
Mr. Chairman and members, the board is detailing out by the 7 members some more itemized professions, such as a manicurist and a nail technician, and an esthetician. You apply through the Minnesota Secretary of State's website. Those get forwarded to the governor's office, and they make their determinations. I have been advised, I can't say by the governor's office directly, but by other boards that I work closely with, if you do create too many steps, such as like a manicurist or a nail technician living in rural Minnesota, seats end up empty because the per diem, in some of the benefits, they are expanding that we can do web-based meetings or electronic meetings, but I was advised not to make the positions too specific or geographically located because they will end up empty.
Seeing no other questions, you're Representative Albright, and you're going to be the last one, and we're going to move on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be brief. And this would go to Ms. Stouse, and I'm looking at the infamous top of page 6, and I'm just wondering, my understanding that under the Human Rights Act, under the Public Accommodation Act, if an establishment were to be found to be in violation of those provisions, would it not be incumbent upon the Cosmetology Examiner's Board to use that as evidence to revoke a license?
Mr. Chairman and members, our board's attorney would not advise us that the refusal of service is a jurisdictional matter under our current laws that provide the scope of practice and our rules. Therefore, we do not have jurisdiction. Just like if a tax issue came before the board, if they didn't pay their taxes, we don't have that like long arm jurisdiction over that to refuse them their right to practice. So the idea is our board attorneys would never advise us to hold anyone accountable under that. It would be the human rights would have to go through their investigation, and then they would make a recommendation to the board. But civil and criminal tend not to go into the board's Office of Administrative Hearings. The attorneys like to, they run them separate, is what we've been advised.
And that's pretty standard operation for most boards. They turn that over to the agency or the group that handles that, mm-hmm. whether it's the Department of Human Rights or the Attorney General. So, members, I think you know what's in store for you when you get to the floor or to the next committee. Would you care to re-refer your bill to GovOps, House File 27? I'll just do it. I'd like to re-refer House File 2762 as amended. Thank you. To GovOps. Are there any? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. You're on to GovOps, sir.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And our next bill is House File 2778, Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Purcell, you've got some, I think Harriet has asked to do some comments on the fiscal part. Do you want to present your bill and then we'll take a step back and allow some of, or would your testifier care to testify first? I'm going to defer to you.
I'll give some introduction and we can proceed. That's fine the way you're talking about it, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
And if we can have some further explanation, I'd be happy to have Mr. Cassidy provide that too. So what we have in front of us, Mr. Chair and members, House File 2778 is titled New Markets Jobs Act, provide tax credits to investors who provide needed capital to existing businesses in Minnesota. The bill, as it is here before you, would authorize $250 million in private investment in the first year of enactment with tax credit of 39% that could be claimed for years 3 through 7. This means that the money will go to work for 2 years in Minnesota before credits would be paid by the state. So I'd just with that brief introduction, if pleases the chair, I'd like to have Mr. Paul Cassidy further explain the bill, and then we can do our best with questions.
Sounds good. Mr. Cassidy, would you care to comment?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good afternoon, members. My name is Paul Cassidy. I'm with the law firm of Stinson Leonard Strait in Minneapolis, and I'm representing Enhanced Capital, which is an investment firm that's done business in the state of Minnesota, but also has worked on the New Markets Tax Credit Program over the past several years, both at the federal level and in individual states around the country. The federal New Markets Tax Program was established during the Clinton administration and enacted by Congress in the year 2000 in order to direct capital investment into existing operating businesses located in low-income communities. Representative Purcell didn't mention that. This is specifically targeted at low-income communities based on the most current U.S. Census tract. This program authorizes investors to receive a tax credit against their federal income tax return in exchange for making equity investments in specialized financial institutions, which are called community development entities, or CDEs. These CDEs can take the form of entities such as the St. Paul Port Authority or an economic development authority that you may have in your individual legislative districts, or investment companies with expertise in managing equity investments. This is a highly competitive program. Between 2020 and 2012, $20 billion in private capital was invested at the federal level under the existing federal program in communities with high poverty, low incomes, and high unemployment rates. It's estimated that the demand for federal New Market Tax Credit Program far exceeds its funding by a ratio of almost 10 to 1. Because of this high demand for access to capital, 13 individual states thus far have chosen to adopt a similar program at the state level in order to attract private capital in their individual states. The proposal that we have before you today would create a new markets program in Minnesota, separate and apart from the federal program. This proposal would authorize a new markets program in Minnesota that would emulate the federal program, utilizing much of the same regulatory framework with one twist. Minnesota would not have to compete at the federal level for federal allocation. Instead, it would have its own pool of dollars from which to draw from. This new program would authorize $250 million in new capital to be deployed in the first year of enactment. That means that all $250 would be on the street and deployed to those low-income communities. Investors after that would have access to a credit for their investment in the community development entity. The CDE must have an allocation agreement with the already have an existing allocation agreement with the United States Treasury and have a service area that includes the state of Minnesota. Allocation awards would be authorized through the Minnesota Department of Economic and the Minnesota DEED. All $250 million of the capital would be required to be deployed the first year. These communities are identified by the U.S. Census Tract, as I said earlier, that have a poverty rate of greater than 20% or median income less than 80% of the area median income. Just like the federal program, the credit totals 39% of the original investment amount and is claimed over a period of 7 years. If you look at the handout, the four-page handout they have in front of you, it'll show that the first 2 years this tax credit is deferred, so there's no hit to the general fund. After that, the tax credit is allocated out over the last 5 years of the program, totaling seven.
Mr. Chairman, could I just stop you real quick? I'm looking at your map here, and you've got a couple of counties over in Wisconsin. This would not affect anything in Wisconsin. It would stop at the St. Croix River, correct?
I apologize, Mr. Chairman. Members, no, it does not include the state of Wisconsin.
Thank you.
This is a federal census map showing those areas which do qualify for the program. Wisconsin would have to do their own program. Finally, Mr. Chairman, this program focuses on extending credit to existing businesses, hopefully growth companies, that are in need of capital. I'll point out a few things that in the brochure and also a few other things that I want to point out. I think that on its way through the process, there will probably be added to this some type of reporting provision that we've seen, whether with the angel credit or something else, in which the department and the industry would be required to report back to the chair of this committee and the committee in the Senate. A lot of these loans are, I guess for lack of a better description, what we talk about in economic development is but-for loans. Participation loans where, let's say, a company needs $5 million for expansion, their local bank can maybe only do two or three. This might get them over the line and get them to five. So the bank, local bank, and this program joined together and put together a finance package in order to get that expansion going. Again, if you look at, I think a lot of you have seen maps of your individual districts. If you haven't, we will get you one to show what areas of your district would be eligible for this type of funding. And if you look at I'm not sure if you have that in your packet, but the state of Minnesota map, there's quite a few areas that would indeed qualify. And then if you look on page two of the four-page handout that we have in front of you, you'll see the flow of dollars and how this process works. Mr. Chairman, with that, I would be welcome to answer questions. I have Mr. Zierko with me as well to anything technical that I'm not able to answer.
Well, we're going to give this about another 12 or 13 minutes. Harriet, did you have some comments that you felt that you should be making about this bill?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think as currently written, there are no administrative funds appropriated to deed, so there is a $5,000 fee, but that raises some questions of what that fee is intended to do or what those funds are for. So I think as is, it would need some clarification language, and there's another part where it needs to be clear where the fees are deposited in. It has accounts, but it doesn't have funds, so that is a concern, at least from the fiscal point of view.
Thank you. Are there any questions for the testifiers? I've got one. and you just kind of brought it up, if a bank makes a business needs a $5 million loan, it really has a $2 million line of credit to the company, so there's still a $3 million gap. Is this investment considered a loan? So there's not only is there a part ownership in the company of some form or another, but is it a loan that they would have to pay back with interest? So it's a 40% or 39% tax credit plus a interest earned on the money loan.
Mr. Chairman and members, my understanding that these are typically done as loans with an interest rate attached and that are expected to be repaid.
Would you like to identify yourself for the record and give more to that answer?
Sure. My name is Jeff Ziarko with Enhanced Capital. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would just add to that, yes, typically every one of the strengths of the New Markets Program is that every community development entity has a little bit different business model. Our firm is typically making loans. You do see the cost of capital for the loan come down materially below market. So, yes, the loans typically have to be paid back, but the business that is, in addition to what Mr. Cassidy identified earlier, that this is very often a program that gets a project over the finish line, that gets the financing completed altogether. The business that is receiving the loan is also typically benefiting in the form of a reduced cost of capital, so lower interest rates or other forms of preferred terms. So it's a better deal than what they would get from a commercial bank.
Thank you. As I understand it, my good friend Lori Lauder would like to add a few comments before we get too far down the road with questions. So if I could ask you to step or grab the out of the chair over there. Ms. Lauder, would you like to come down? And you've only been in economic development for a few years, so your words of wisdom. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the tape and share with us what your thoughts.
Great. Thank you, Representative Mahoney, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon. My name is Lori Lauder. I'm the Senior Vice President of Business and Intergovernmental Affairs at the St. Paul Port Authority. We, too, have a bill on New Markets Tax Credits, and I want to thank those of you who have signed on to that bill. It's right now in the Senate at Senate File 2232, and in the House, Mr. Dabney's bill, House File 2862. We anticipate, and we have met with these gentlemen last week to come together at some point, hopefully soon, with one bill that all of us can get comfortable with. There are some distinctions. I won't go into it. You do have a handout. I don't know if you were looking at that earlier. It's one with the Port Authority's logo on the top. Mr. Chair, I'd just say very simply, and it was very well described by Mr. Cassidy, that this is a program for the low-income areas of Minnesota. And yes, it wouldn't be Wisconsin, but it's quite a busy map. I mean, it's a really good description, I think, of the areas in the state that would qualify under this new state program. And I would just lastly indicate on the last second page of my handout, you have kind of a smattering of project examples. We've done our projects, I think we've done five or six now, on the east side of St. Paul. The former 3M manufacturing campus is 46 acres, and we've provided about two or three projects, the Eastside Family Health Clinic, the Health East Ambulance and EMT Training Center facility, and then down the road a piece, Baldinger Bakery, a third-generation bakery. So, yes, this program would be both for private sector businesses with the private investors getting the 39% tax credit, as well as nonprofit entities would qualify as well, at least in our bill. I have not looked at this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That's it for today from me. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Ms. Lauder. I would hope that you, the two witnesses on the end there, stick around just in case there's other questions. I will say this, that Ballinger Bakery is a delightful addition to the neighborhood, especially when the wind is correct. Representative Kiefer, you had a question?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. It's more of just making sure I understand what's going on here. Let me just get this straight. We're going to increase wages with the minimum wage mandate. We've already increased the cost of doing business in the state. Luckily, we repealed some of those taxes last week. But we're sending the message in Minnesota that people who earn money or have income or are employers need to pay a little bit more, their fair share. But we see that potentially there's going to be some negative impacts from this, apparently. So now we've got to spend more tax money to fix these problems in the rural areas. Am I understanding this correctly, or is there another solution maybe?
Mr. Chairman, if I might, and then I will defer to my colleagues here. This is not just for rural areas. It is for low-income areas. And, you know, when you look at the panoply of economic development assistance, a big issue for businesses in their effort and in their quest to grow is access to capital. And so, as the other gentleman here explained, this is a way to provide additional capital to those businesses, particularly in low-income areas, which may have some issues with marketing their land. I would defer, Mr. Chair, to my colleagues.
Mr. Cassidy, or...
Mr. Chairman, I would only add to that you know, this is one more tool to leverage capital. I mean, this is a program that, by and large, when these CDs are authorized, they go to their investors. Their investors are typically, in this program, I think almost exclusively, insurance companies. And those insurance companies receive that tax credit over the course of 7 years, and it's balanced against their tax liability, their premium tax liability in the state in which they're operating.
I'm blanking on your name, and I apologize for that. But do other states do this, and what kind of success rate? And we've only got about 4 minutes, and we've got another question after that. But if you could talk about, is this done in a lot of other states, and is there a success rate in some of the areas that be comparable to that this would be available in Minnesota?
Sure, I'd be happy to. Currently, 13 states have enacted their own new markets programs. As you might imagine, every state's done it a little bit differently. They've tried to steer investment in different directions. I am not aware of any state where they have failed to deploy the amount of capital that was authorized to be raised, supported by tax credits. So the money, as far as I'm aware, every state has the CDs that have participated have gotten the money out the door. I can tell you, you know, to give you a flavor, in addition to what the St. Paul Port Authority has done, I can give you a sense in other states where we've participated and we're deploying capital. We've helped finance additional equipment for a paper mill in Maine that, was obviously, it's a very difficult business right now. They wanted to expand into a different kind of pulp. We were able to make a loan helping them buy new equipment. We financed an IT services company in Florida that was that had been looking for venture capital for 2 years. We were able to provide financing to purchase new equipment and hire new engineers.
Representative Albright, we have a couple of minutes here, and do you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And one of them just goes to a comment that was made earlier, but are we taking collateral positions in any of these financing arrangements?
Who would like to answer that one?
I'm sorry, is the state taking collateral positions?
Mr. Albright.
Mr. Chair, yes, that's the question.
The state would not be. The state's role is to provide the tax credits to support the raising of the capital. Depending on the individual loan, certainly, you know, the CDE that is making the loan to that company would ask for collateral if that were appropriate for that particular transaction.
Mr. Chair. So in the construct of that, then, in light of the repayment or under Section 8 under the performance fee, I'm just trying to understand in terms of what happens if the project in question defaults. How is the program made whole on the lending out of those? It's really a performance credit rather than a loan, correct?
Sure. The performance fee you're referring to is essentially designed to make sure that the CDEs who are participating raise the capital that they say they're going to and then deploy it, and that that money stays deployed. And we would be penalized if we fail to perform our role in this process. So that's what that piece is for. To your point about what happens if a particular borrower were to default, the program require, in order for the full run of tax credits to be earned by the CDE's investors, the money has to stay at work for a full 7 years. So if, for instance, a loan were made to a particular company and it were a 3-year loan, the CDE would then have to go make another loan for the remaining term of the program so that that money is continuously at work for the full 7 years. In the event of a default, the requirement to redeploy that capital would depend on what the recovery was. So if it was a $10 million loan and $5 million of that was recovered, then that $5 million would have to be reinvested as though it were paid back to us. So it would depend in that case on the recovery. The reason for that, I mean, these are risky loans, and part of the point of the tax credit is to encourage private investment capital to make riskier loans in areas where, you know, we know historically businesses aren't able to access traditional sources of capital. So we work very hard to make sure that those kind of default situations don't happen, but it is the case that the program is designed to attract capital into areas where the private market right now is saying it's too risky.
I think we're going to cut this off here so we can get to the last bill for the day. Very quickly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And very brief answer.
We heard discussions 2 weeks ago about venture capital in the state of Minnesota and the lack thereof. How is this related to venture capital? And I know that's kind of a generic question, but help me out.
I would just say very briefly, if you think about venture capital as younger companies that are startups, typically you see a little bit older, more established companies that are seeking growth capital. That's the kind of the business you'll see more often in this program. So think of it as sort of the next stage after venture.
Thank you. Members, I am going to move. I'm going to re-refer House File 2778 to taxes. Any further comments? Witnesses? All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed, same sign. Aye. Thank you, Mr. Representative Zell and
Member.
Company. And our next bill is Ward 2586. I'm going to take this brief moment here to notify members that we will be having night hearings next week on the Thursday night, the 13th, the 18th, and the 20th. And you have Representative Gunther to thank tonight that we don't have one, because the famous pork chop feed is this evening.
Oh, thank you.
The pork chop feed. When's that?
Representative Ward, would you like to present your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, we're talking today about House File 2586 right now. And members, this has to deal with the Minnesota Investment Fund. I have with me today Commissioner Clark Sieben and others that will help me with this testimony once I just kind of introduce the bill. And 2586, members, the Minnesota Investment Fund, as you all remember, last year was one of the great success stories that we had in economic development in 2013. We invested $30 million last year in that fund to expand business growth in the state of Minnesota, and it happened. It happened significantly. Grants and forgivable loans made by deed from the Minnesota Investment Fund have played a big part in major employers deciding to move into or expand to Minnesota. This bill, 2586, seeks to set aside 3% of the MIF appropriation for administrative costs. And you know, generally, members, really, no one here likes carving out a chunk of appropriation for administrative expenses. We get that. I get that. MIF, however, presents a unique case. Negotiations to get a company like Shutterfly or gearing off manufacturing are extensive and involve a series of high-level meetings. Governor Dayton himself flew over many locations that ultimately resulted in major employees, along with the commissioner, moving to the state of Minnesota. So, members, the 3% administrative cost would allow for NIF funding to be, you know, Deed would use that for tracking the NIF funding, for getting the results for the NIF funding, for the return on investment figures for NIF funding. Make sure the NIF funding gets the right people to evaluate the program, to protect the taxpayers' investment. I'll say that again, to protect the taxpayers' investment. And just members to make sure that we're accountable and responsible with the MIF allocation appropriation. With that, Mr. Chair, members, I'll stop and turn it over to Commissioner for comments, and then we'll be both available for questions, and we've got other staff members from Deed here that will also be available.
Well, welcome to the commission to the committee, Commissioner. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I'm Katie Clark-Sieben, Commissioner of Deed. It's good to see all of you again. As Representative Ward mentioned, this is about accountability, and we are only asking for what we think is truly necessary in order for us to effectively manage this new $30 million ongoing appropriation the department has. As you'll remember, the Minnesota Investment Fund in the past has received one-time appropriations of anywhere from $1 million to $7 million at given points in time. Now that we have $30 million of ongoing funding, we need to ensure that we have the administrative dollars needed to effectively operate this money. This is not a new spending ask. This is 3% of the existing appropriation for MIF. I'd like to just share some detail with you on why this is necessary. So first, we currently track all of the MIF money through a system called IDB. This was built in 1993 on Microsoft Access. Microsoft no longer supports Access. There are Minit staff currently employed by Minit that do have those skills and capabilities to support that program, but this is simply a program that is outdated and no longer being used, and we have a need to transition to a more updated database. We track all of our MIF offers, and as you'll remember, the MIF program operates in such that we offer a company, we'll use an example, $1 million, but we do not pay out that money in one check. As the company spends money and sends us receipts, we then reimburse the company for those expenses. And so it's multiple transactions that are happening with every single MIF award that we're doing, and we need to make sure that we are effectively tracking every single transaction. In addition, this database is also where we track what a city or a county might be offering that same company, so that we take a total look at what is the package that the company receives, not just the state dollars. It's also important to show historical data so that we can at any given point in time pull up what has the company received in economic development incentives and be aware of that full amount. It also allows us to pull reports by geographic region in the state, by business industry, by business size, a variety of data. So anytime you're asking us for data, this is the database we would be going to. Truly, this is about making sure that we fully operate this program in an accountable manner and that we are consistent with compliance. The 3% ask is in line with Job Creation Fund, what you passed last year for administrative purposes. It's $900,000. And again, just want to reiterate, this is not new spending. This is a portion of the existing MIF funds so that we can make sure that these dollars are effectively utilized and tracked, and we will only use what is necessary of that 3%. If there's any way we can save dollars, we will absolutely do so.
Uh,
I'm first on the list. I wonder how that came about. Thank you, Commissioner. I have two questions here, and I'll give you both the questions. The first one should be yes or no. Would, in the instance of those two examples that you gave where the governor had to go and meet with executives, would his airfare be covered by that? And then the second question is, this is a database that you're purchasing to maintain records. What other programs other than MIF would use that same software to track its programs? Because I want to make sure that MIF is only paying the part that MIF is using, and if it's XYZ program, they should pay their part.
Mr. Chair, members, the governor's travel is not paid out of programmatic budgets. That's paid out of DEED's travel budget. And I would like to invite, if I may, Mr. Chair, Kevin McKinnon, our Executive Director of Business and Community Development, to help answer your second question on the various programs and tracking. Thank you.
Ms. McKinnon, good to have you in front of us again. Please identify yourself for the tape and other uses for this database.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kevin McKinnon, I'm the Director of Economic Development Programs at DEED. Mr. Chair and members, the question related to what else does this database track? This database tracks every program that flows through DEED, every appropriation. It's integrated with our, it ultimately will be integrated with our SWIFT data, SWIFT accounting system, that's a statewide accounting system that we use. This database does manage, as I mentioned, all of the other appropriations that come through there, and yes, there are other programs that would be paying for this, not entirely just through MIF, but yes, programs like the Job Creation Fund, the Minnesota Job Skills Partnership, those types of things would help contribute to that.
And just a quick follow-up, is it proportional to their use, or is it just a set dollar figure?
Mr. Chair, members, it would be probably more like a set dollar figure simply because some of the programs obviously are not as large as this, the Minnesota Investment Fund or the Job Creation Fund, so it probably would be more proportional like that.
Yeah. Representative Norton, did you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we were kind of asking questions in the same line, and I know there's been a very important program and very successful one for our state, so I appreciate that it's there. But like Representative Mahoney, I share some concerns about carving money out that could be used for the program for administrative duties. That just kind of gnaws at me. And the other concern is that I believe there are other bills out there asking for more money for SMIF, the Southern Minnesota, coming before us in the next few days. So not from the department, but from other people. So there is still a desire to have more money in the system, and yet we're taking money away right now for administrative duties. So there's a little issue there that I'm concerned with. And as far as record keeping, do the individual MIFs not help you with that by record keeping what happens within their institutions that they can't share some of it back to you? And then in addition to that, I guess along with Representative Mahoney, it seems to me if you're going to, if part of this is a programmatic software issue, that there, it should be shared not just, you know, from this fund, but throughout all the programs should put a proportion of their, I don't know how you would figure that out, but proportionally to each of the systems that's using it so that this one program isn't carrying the brunt of that. So, and then before they answer, Mr. Chair, it was my understanding that you weren't having a meeting tonight because it's Rochester Day on the Hill, and from 5 to 7 at St. Paul College, they are all expecting all of you over there. So I hope before you go grab a pork chop, you stop by and support the Chamber and the citizens of Rochester.
Well, we'll have to find
that's
out
a commercial.
Which one goes later? Hmm? Wait a minute. I think that one goes later. Okay. So you have a whole bunch of questions there. Who would care to answer if you remember them? Commissioner.
I will. Mr. Chair, members, and please, if I miss something, let me know. I think there are two different MIFs in the state of Minnesota. So one is the Minnesota Investment Fund, which is a loan program that DEED administers. The other is the Minnesota Initiative Foundations, which are located across our state run by the McKnight Foundation. What we're talking about today is DEED's Minnesota Investment Fund program, separate from the Minnesota Initiative Fund. So I just wanted to clarify that piece and make sure sometimes it can get confusing with the term MIF being frequently used. As Kevin mentioned, this database, so we currently use a database called IDB that is the Microsoft Access Program, can no longer be supported. We need to have a tracking database with a $30 million ongoing appropriation to make sure that we are clearly tracking all of those funds and can pull reporting at any given point in time. Each economic development incentive program that we have would be contributing to that database, so it wouldn't just be set up for MIF solely, but we have a funding need. There has been programs developed over recent years that have had no administrative dollars attached to them. Our staffing budget is extremely lean at the moment, and we want to make sure that we are administering these programs to the best of our ability and ensuring accountability for these taxpayer dollars. And so we are bringing this issue to all of you as a committee to let you know that we see and have a need for this database in order to track this $30 million ongoing funding. It was a request this past legislative session, but didn't end up moving forward. So we again are bringing this to you to let you know that this is a need that our agency has.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you.
Or did you have a follow-up, Representative Norton?
I'm good, thank you.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Steven, I'm curious. I applaud the effort for openness and transparency and so forth so that the people of the state of Minnesota know where and how their tax dollars are being spent. I was going to ask some questions about the tracking process, but I think that you've answered that good enough for now anyway. I do want to say, though, that, you know, as difficult as it may be to track it, and I appreciate the news releases and so forth that come from your office. I mean, it seems like weekly there are, you know, announcements about, you know, something else that's being awarded and so forth. But my other question is that how do we, I mean, we're tracking these expenses, but how do we track administrative expenses? Mm-hmm. It's two different things. I mean, related, but
Commissioner,
how do we know we're getting our bang for our buck in the dollars that are being used to do this tracking?
Well, Representative Fabian, let me just tell you this, that I have on more than one occasions called the department over there at 7 o'clock at night thinking I was going to leave a message and gotten the person I was leaving the message for on the phone. So just so you know, and I'm a guy that likes 40-hour weeks. I don't know why I'm doing this job, but... Who would like to catch that question?
We'll both add. Mr. Chair, members, so when we track administrative costs, it's actually quite easy because they're very low. it's salaries, it's basic office supplies, and then the larger buy, which is why we're in front of you today, is technology and ensuring that we have the database in place that we need to continue to do our work in an effective manner and make sure that we have accountability and tracking of all of these dollars. As I mentioned earlier in the testimony, when a MIF award goes out, it doesn't go out in one check. A $500,000 MIF award is going to have multiple transactions because the company needs to spend the money before we will reimburse them. And so there are multiple reasons why this database is needed. And Kevin, if you have any additional info you wanted to add.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, the other aspect to this from how we track administrative costs for this is when we do have administrative funds like this, our staff are charging to these different accounts for their salaries based on the time that they're spending on those projects. Currently, we have some staff that are charging four or five different accounts based upon these appropriations and based upon what they're working on. At that same time, with the Minnesota Investment Fund, some of these transactions are a little different. As the commissioner mentioned, not all the money goes out immediately. But remember, these are also loans in most cases, and they're going out 7 to 10 years. So we're monitoring and making sure that the companies are still in compliance with that. And that's a big part of what we're doing here with this program, and with the enhanced amounts that we're looking at, ramping up that compliance over the next several years.
And we have, we're going to go with just a few minutes longer. Representative Albright, you had a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this would be just a function from the standpoint of to the database itself. Did you, what type of RFP process did you conduct, or is it a sole source, single source for the infrastructure itself? Can you elaborate in terms of what led you to believe that you needed it? And from whom?
Mr. Chair, Representative, so we have not yet put out an RFP for this new technology because we don't currently have funding today. So today we are managing the process with the current IDB database through support with Minute, but we have a need to be able to put an RFP out and go through the process of finding new technology.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have another follow-up to this, so I'll be brief. So in light of that, answer the question, how might you know exactly what to ask for if you don't know what the RFP is going to drive back in terms of the cost situation at the time the RFP is received?
Mm-hmm. Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, members, we have knowledge of various databases that exist and how much they might cost, but we have not zeroed in on exactly which one we would use until we know we actually have funding. It would be above and beyond the 3% that we're asking for in MIF, and other programs would also need to contribute to that amount. So we are asking for the lowest amount possible that we think we could get this work done within.
And Mr. Chair?
Representative Albright.
Thank you. Has there ever been precedent of a set-aside been established in the past for a MIF project?
Commissioner or Mr. McKenna?
So it wouldn't be used for problematic.
Mr. Chair, Representative Albright, I'm not necessarily aware of anything specific other than perhaps some disaster pieces that we have dealt with MIF over the past several years.
Meaning natural disasters.
Natural disasters. where we've used
clarification.
Used funds for that from a carve-out perspective, but...
I was wondering if they were talking about my checkbook.
Yeah.
And if I may, Mr. Chair and members, I believe, and this is before my time with the department, but I believe years ago the thinking was to put money into an operating budget and not pull from program budgets, and over time we've transitioned a bit to having a certain percent of a program be used for administrative costs, with the thinking that as program budgets fluctuate year over year, if there's a certain percentage that can be used for administrative costs, it's directly correlated to the amount of work that might be required for that program. So if we have $1 million of MIF, it requires a certain amount of administrative costs versus $30 million in MIF, as one example. And so that percentage would fluctuate.
And Representative Fabian, did you have a question that I cut you off at?
Well, I did, Mr. Chair. Thank you, if I could.
We're going to be done here in a minute, and this is going to get laid over, so we'll...
Commissioner, you're talking about your staff and so forth. I'm just curious to know about how many staff members do you have that work on these types of things currently? Will the new software free them up to do other things, or do we have to hire more people? And then the other thing is, do you contract out for any kind of grant evaluations?
Commissioner or Mr. McKenna?
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, currently we have about 50 people in my division, the Business Community Development Division. We have 5 senior loan officers that work almost exclusively on MIF, outside of their many other responsibilities, such as monitoring 300 Job Z deals and different programs that exist there. So staff are doing multiple things, and at the same time, this would not necessarily take less time from them entering things into the database. It's simply a replacement of the existing database that we currently have and have had for many years. The staff, once they begin this process, use that database, and then as it's continually monitored, staff are always adding back into it. So from an efficiency standpoint, it helps obviously the rest of the department, and certainly all of us understand where the money is at all times.
And if I can provide just one point of clarification, so it's a Mr. Chair members, it's 50 staff within the Business and Community Development Division that oversees about 40 different programs. So MIF is one of those programs that they're working on.
With that being said, we're going to lay this bill over for possible inclusion. This is going to be coming back, so if you have other questions, the commissioner or their advocates would be happy to sit down in your office and have more further conversation. Mm-hmm. But I think there's another committee coming in, so with that, we're adjourned. Enjoy the